afternoon, good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank you for attending my talk on Privaterra Report from the Field. I'd like to take this opportunity first, before anything, to thank you for attending this session, and also the Chaos Computer Club and their supporters to making it possible for me to present to you today. Over the course of the hour that I have with you, I'm going to speak about the work that Privaterra is involved in, give you a little bit of history, but do this in a very interactive, visual way as well. So instead of just speaking about what we've done, is actually show you some pictures, and we'll really want some input from the community here as well. So first of all, my name is Robert Guerra. I'm the managing director of Privaterra. And for the talk today, these are the key points that I'm going to talk about. First of all is just to give you a little bit of background on Privaterra, how it got started, what is it, the type of projects that we've done, the type of things that we do. When I talk about working in the field, what that means, what is the field, the security workshops that we do, I'll give you a view of what that is. And answer and show you a couple of questions. What's there in the field? What can be done? Remembering the context. Something about secret archives. Some lessons learned and questions and answers. What's more important is, first of all, is just telling you an idea of what Privaterra is. Privaterra comes as a result of some individuals, including myself, back in 2000, who very much were participating in privacy discussions, security and crypto discussions, both online and in conferences. And we saw that there was a lot of discussion about human rights. There's a lot of discussions about helping people who work with human rights with secure communications. This is right after the discussions related to the Clipper chip, to whether encryption is legal or not in the United States and other countries. And there was some work that was originally being done by the American Association for the Advancement of Science and others to try to get some human rights organizations, people who work with human rights, people who work, whose information needs protecting, to have some technical assistance. And so it was really the one or two individuals that were doing this. And we thought, well, it might be a good idea to try to bring some set of people to help this. And we thought, instead of just talking about it, what is it that we could do to develop a specific project, to develop specific set of things that we could do to bring the ideas, to bring the tools of security, of privacy, and technology to some human rights organizations, but also to get from them what their context is, what their environment is, what's happening to them, seeing how those tools are used, what are some of the problems, and feeding that back into the community, such as yours, but others as well. But more importantly is, because in some of the environments, countries are very repressive, there's a lot of surveillance. Are there things that we could learn from those environments that then get fed into the discussions around policy, the discussions around protests? Are there arguments that we can use from other countries? And so we had this idea. What did we do? Well, first of all is we started talking to colleagues and to organizations to see what could be done, what could be set up, and to some organizations that could support us as well, too. One of the first meetings was in around 2000, meeting with the cypherpunk community based in the San Francisco Bay Area, because there are some individuals there who'd been interested in crypto, who talked about human rights, just to get their input as well, too. To also activist community as well, too. This was the same time of the Dmitry Sklyarov case, which is this case of this Russian programmer who built some code and talked about a security fault in the Adobe Reader and was arrested at the DEF CON conference. And we also spoke to some of the people who were involved in defending Dmitry and others to see, can we take some of this energy that's there, the interest that people have, and try to bring that to a specific project. And also at different conferences that some of us participated at the time, are there people there that were interested as well? So how could we bring these different communities together? And so from my home in Toronto, which is like here, full of a lot of snow, and spending a lot of time online, virtually, trying to get different people together, tried to develop what are some specific tasks, a mission for the organization that we could do, to make it into very simple things that we could try to do and then try to get some results. So we basically broke it down into three main things that we wanted to do, is training. Are there specific tools that we could show? Are there specific knowledge that we would have about security that we could help organizations with? And so the first thing was, are there basic concepts that maybe we understand really, really well, but others just don't? And could we help organizations with that? Could we help them with secure communications tools? At the time, PGP was very popular and still is. Are there other set of tools that we could help people with if they just don't have a manual or have never heard of the tool? And then what is it that we could use for these organizations to collaborate to use them online? Then are there ways, as I said, that we could bring some of this knowledge that these and the experience of working with these people back to the community and put that as all into the advocacy community as well, too. The projects that we've done since 2000, and I'll show you some of the pictures very shortly, is we've worked almost in all the continents so far, in Africa, in Central Asia, in Kazakhstan, some places in Europe, particularly in Latin America, and Southeast Asia most recently as well, and have also spoken with the press as well, too. Spoken them, what particular things have we done when I say that we've done some activities. We've spoken with individuals, we've spoken with organizations to see what is it that they would need, just have a discussion with them. But also when we talk about tools, we talk about teaching, it's getting some of the language that's used at these conferences, so and at other places as well, too. If we talk about encryption algorithms, 1024 tool for 8 size key, does this mean anything to an average user who just cares about bringing a criminal to justice? They don't. They just want to get their things done. So, you know, what is it that we would have to adjust in terms of the language? Or do they have a technical person who was really interested in those things? So those are some of the things that we tried to do in terms of the methods that we tried to use. Focusing that we're talking about different cultures in Latin America is very different than working in the United States. In the United States, some organizations want you to come, do the training, and leave. And organizations in Latin America, you have to spend some time with them before, get to know how the organization works. You have to start building trust with them and then stay some time with them as well, too. So they really have a sense of that you're there not just as a foreigner who wants to go, but to actually give them some knowledge, give them some tools so they can help themselves. And so that's the approach that we try to do. And again, teach them some basic knowledge around the internet and security. So, for example, one of the questions that is maybe very obvious to a lot of people here is how the internet works, how email works, how the web works. A lot of organizations that we help, both in Europe, in North America, and in South America, have misconceptions on how the internet works, haven't really had that explained to them. And if you're going to talk about security, if you're going to talk about vulnerabilities, that is a very key thing that needs to be discussed first. And so we do that, and we spent some time as well, too. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to take you through a visual tour. I've spoken for almost 10 minutes, and because it's towards the end of the day, let's try to spice up with some pictures. So in terms of some of the workshops that we do, it really depends on the type of organization and the type of need. Sometimes it's just an organization, it's a particular worker in the field that says, I need training because I'm going to be sent to somewhere in Africa, or I'm going to be sent to Russia, I need to collect some information, I need to send it back to London, I need to send it back to Berlin, and I know that there's surveillance. What is it that you can do or someone can do to help me? And so we'll do individualized training. We might also help a small group of people as well. So when we talk about one-to-one, it could be one person or a group of people that we work with. That's kind of symbolic. What it means sometimes in some context is, depending on the technology that's available, it really is a workshop that's outside. If you want to explain how the internet works and you have no power and you have no internet, it can be a bit of a challenge. And so if you put a sheet of paper, you get some colored markers, you can be really creative and people can really quite understand. In some of the places that we've gone, in some of the places where there's real issues in terms of violence, in terms of ongoing conflict, it's really difficult to get to a place. Some of you who have maybe flown to Berlin might have the picture of the airport when you arrived. It's probably very different than this airport. And that's the type of airport that you might find when you travel to places. And so if the conditions aren't right, if it's raining too much, you just can't land. Or maybe on the way to the airport, it's rained and your car gets stuck. Or maybe you need to leave because there's going to be a military convoy on the way. And so it's not easy to do. And it's also the people, if they're attending an event somewhere, this is the travel that they have to do. So it can be quite a challenge. Some places, like this one, this was in Eastern Congo, are in a constant state of armed conflict. If any of you follow the news, you might see that there was a UN soldiers were sent into Eastern Congo just maybe a week or so ago, just before Christmas. And so some places are really problematic. This is an event that we did about a year ago. We really wanted to train people there because they know the conditions really well. We don't want to necessarily put people who don't know the conditions at risk. And so this is just to give you an idea. In terms of traveling, again, it can be really complicated. It can be really dangerous to travel some of the places. But what's very important is to really get a sense of an understanding of where you're traveling and what the conditions are. As you may have seen in the talk just previous in regards to New Orleans and Iraq, the issue of understanding how changes occur. And so an example in point, a situation that happened to us when we were in Congo, is we were just in the middle of the street, at a visiting the internet cafe, and we see a UN armed vehicle drive by. And so is this a good thing? Are they just driving by? Is it that there's a problem? All we know is that the problem is with young men, usually with guns, is when you have to be careful. Well, first we see this, and then we see men with flags making a lot of noise, some in military fatigues, and so we start to get really afraid. What is it that we do? And the person that's local with us says, no, it's no problem, you know, just watch. And so those of us who aren't familiar with the context are really afraid and don't know what to do. And so then we see motorcycles come. And again, a lot of people making a lot of noise. It can be problematic. But then at the end we realize it's not a protest, it's not some military takeover, it just happens to be the birthday of Bob Marley. And Bob Marley is someone who is really appreciated in this part of Africa, and the flags that they were was the Jamaican flag, and that's why they were waving. But at first, we didn't know. And so the importance of really having people who are local really help out in these type of conditions is really, really important. And that's anyone that's interested in doing any of this type of work, that's a point that I really want to stress. Getting into, again, some specific pictures of different things that we've done, I'll go to show just some pictures of a workshop we did in Kazakhstan, Russia, and in Latin America. Now, Kazakhstan is a country that some of you may be able to place on a map. It's a very oil-rich country that's just north of, almost north of Afghanistan. There's a country in between. Former Soviet Republic. Speak Russian or speak Kazakh, there was a funder who wanted to organize a workshop for technology people and activists in that region, and so I don't speak Russian, and so we had to find trusted translators, and we also had to find places to do the event. And so when we arrived, we find this very huge, what's called a hotel now. It was apparently a hotel for the Communist Party when Kazakhstan was part of the Soviet Union. And so what do you do if you want to connect to the internet? Is there internet? Is there dial-up? Because it was owned and run by the Communist Party. Is there surveillance built in? We really don't know. And then you go inside, and you can find that there's computers and maybe a classroom. And so what you think at first glance can be deceptive. The problem that we had here is that they had such a tight firewall, but their technical person wasn't in. And so no open SSH ports, nothing, and there was no one that could help us. And so we had the technology, and we had to spend some time just doing some explanations with a translator. At another training there as well, too, people spend a lot of time working on some of the problems or in some of the tools that we showed them. And again, as you can see from the previous picture, some people are old, some people are young, and that's another thing that you have to do as well, too, is when you work with organizations, there's a difference in the understanding of the technology. You might be able to teach young people very quickly, but to teach someone that's maybe 70, 80 years old, they have habits that are very hard to change. And so it's quite a challenge that way as well, too. As I mentioned earlier, some of our work has been in South America, and one of the two countries that we've done most of our work, one is Colombia. This is a picture of Bogota, a city of 6 million people. And there we worked with different human rights organizations, visited different organizations to see how they were using technology, give them some idea in terms of what suggestions they could implement, but also conducted a couple of workshops. And here you see a picture of kind of the type of people that you find in the classroom, kind of a mixture of men and women. And here you see one of the women participants actually organizing one of the exercises, so just trying to get some feedback with her fellow students as well, too. The other thing as well is we also did some work in Peru, very close to Colombia as well, too. There we work with the coordinator of human rights, where there's been a very strong campaign, a very long campaign for many things, but a very priority cause that was going on at the time and still is now, is to extradite Alberto Fujimori, who was the president several years ago, who then left of Japanese origin, who then left Peru when some of the financial problems were being discovered, went to Japan, said, "I'm a Japanese citizen," and because Japan has no extradition treaty with any country, if you're a Japanese citizen, Japan wouldn't give him up to any country. He very recently visited, I think it was Chile, and Chile and Peru do have an extradition treaty, so they're in the process of trying to take this gentleman to trial in Peru. And when we were there, we worked with groups like Amnesty International and others to tell them about some of the security issues and to do some training as well, too. So there we had a colleague from Lima. Here there's a picture of her working with someone from Amnesty and showing them how email encryption works and how one of the plugins works for Pegasus Mail. Any questions so far?
Yeah. Have you ever worked with organizations you later found out you shouldn't or you would not work with again? Because I'm quite sure that there is a gray area between just opposition work and then, well, other.
That's a very good question, and that was during the process of finding out how we would work and with the type of organizations that we would work with, is how to select partners, but how to deal with that problem. And so one of the things that we did, and the reason why some of our work has taken a long time to do, is that it's really through a network that we try to pick partners. So right now, if an organization approaches us and says, you know, we've heard about you, we're working in the U.S., we have this issue with the FBI, can you help us? What we do is we say, you know, we try to get an understanding of what some of their problems are, and then ask, groups like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch and others, have they worked with them before? And so it's really through a reference network. What we try to stay away from is we try to stay with known human rights organizations because they tend to collect information and send it sometimes out of the country as well. So it's really easy to check on the individuals or particularly the organization. So far, we haven't run into an individual or organization that we've actually trained that maybe a year later we say, oh, we made a mistake. But my response to the law enforcement question that we've not been asked yet is, what if law enforcement asks us, well, why are you doing this, and don't you know that this organization is illegal? The one place where this is the case now is in Kazakhstan. The foundation that got us to teach to the network has now been outlawed by the government and all the people expelled. So I believe that if we go back, we might be jailed. When I've been asked in Canada, I basically say, well, we're just teaching the same tools that banks use and the same type of methodology. So we don't get into very covert. We just use very available tools. And so we haven't run into that. We're just very careful in terms of who we select and who we work with. The picture that you have here, it's a very good question, though, and one that anyone who would like to work in this has to really deal with that problem, because if you do select someone, it might also implicate you as well, too. So then you can get on lists and not be able to travel. I know of other colleagues who have worked with environmental organizations, and particularly in the U.S., and they are on the fly list. So whenever they travel in the U.S., they always get searched now. But this is also the case of university professors that have worked with some things as well, too. But a good question. This next photograph is one of Guatemala City, one where we've visited probably about 8 times over the last 4 years, and where Privatera really started most of its work. It was because there was an organization there who found out about some of the work that we were doing in the United States, that knew we spoke Spanish as well, to say, look, we need some training. We do some workshops for security for human rights organizations. Can you come and give a 2-day lecture on just tools and things that you think might be important? You'll see another picture soon, but it's a city that the buildings aren't usually more than 10 stories high, because I think it was in 76 or in 80, there was a very strong earthquake that almost flattened the whole city, so it's very earthquake prone. The current capital, Guatemala City, is the new capital. The previous capital in the 18th century was flattened by an earthquake, Antigua Guatemala. And so it's one that, it's a very interesting country, one because it has a lot of volcanoes and things like that, so it's very pretty. It has a very sad history because its government was overthrown by one planted by the U.S. The level of violence was just... I've lost. There we go. Was just terrible. One of the interesting things about Guatemala is the resilience of the people. And this is one of the things that hearing the talk yesterday in terms of that we've lost the war, that we have to give up, that there's nothing more that we can do. A country like this had a military dictatorship that lasted many years. There were huge atrocities and war crimes committed against the people, but the people did not give up. And when the situation was right, they've been able to do a lot of things. So the one message that one gets when working in the field is one should not give up. I mean, there are going to be very bad times. There are times when you think that you have nothing left, that you'll maybe lose many rights, but there still have to be people that that stay engaged and that try to do their best. Getting to one of the workshops that were there, this is one of the first ones. You can see in the background, the very first time we did a workshop there, we did two. So the first one is we tried to be a little bit technical because the round of conversations that we had with people is that they were technical, that they use computers, and we thought, okay, we're going to explain to them what different type of encryption algorithms are like. We're going to spend a day and a half on theory, on different encryptions, about public key cryptography. And halfway through the first day, we realized that when they said that they were technical, that meant very different than what we thought being technical. And the colleague that was helping me at the time, as you can see in the background, all the notes on the back are all in English. Of course, the people there don't speak English, they speak Spanish. And so it was a big challenge for them to understand what was being said, even though it was being translated, because they would want it in their own language. And one of the first things that we learned very quickly is, in the country, it's better if you can actually do the presentation in their own language. And so maybe spend time, train someone who knows the local language, because they will understand a lot better. And so that was one of the really first lessons that I learned. It may be really intuitive, but this was the case of working with someone from the United States who thought, well, everyone will understand English. That may be different here in Europe, but that was a very quick lesson that was learned as well, too. And going back, what we also learned as well, too, is that it's important to work with individuals, as you saw with the picture with the penguins. It's really important to work with one or two people, to work on the computers that they will work on, not necessarily in workshop. And so here is two individuals. We were showing them a secure database tool, and we just spent some time with them. Afterwards as well, too, as you saw, there's a group of people as well, too. So this is someone that we had trained, showing her colleagues as well, too. What we've also done as well is we've worked with some universities as well to try to bring students or professors to meet and understand how some of the different organizations we work with, what they do. So about almost 3 years ago now, I helped advise a professor from the University of Toronto and three of his students. And they filmed a documentary in regards to what the situation is not only in Guatemala, but in southern Mexico as well, too. So here, one of the students who now works with the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, I think was explaining a particular way to do disk encryption with OpenBSD to some technical Linux experts in Guatemala. So as you can see, it ranges from using presentations outside to really spending some time with people as well, too. You saw some computers there. So when you talk about IT infrastructure, what is it that you find in the field? What is it that you find in countries that you visit that you want to help organizations? So the first thing that we try to do, and we would suggest people to do as well, too, is just when you visit an organization before you start, just tour around the organization and see what they have. And you'll see that in leading organizations, you might have things like this hanging from the wall. There may be, I think this was the case of the organization that has about 100 people, and they were using 8-port hubs. And they said their internet was really slow. And some of the cables that were on the ground were like this. And so the internet might not work. It's just because you might have water come on it. You might have mice eat the cables. And so one of the things to do is, that's a real problem. But if it's a hub, as you know, if someone just connects to the hub, they can just listen to the whole traffic as well, too. So if you're talking about secure communications or security for this organization, do you recommend that they all use VPNs, or do you recommend that they all switch to switches instead? And so that's one of the things that one has to deal with. But again, organizations can have computers, and sometimes the biggest problem for some of the trainers, particularly when they come to other countries, like coming to Germany as well, too, is that the keyboards might be very different. So I think that the biggest challenge was working on a Russian keyboard and an Arabic keyboard. Also on a German keyboard, the keys are a little bit different. So if you have a password that you remember because of where the keys are on your keyboard, they may not work when you go to other countries. In terms of, you saw some technology in terms of what are specific examples or specific things that we may have done. So there was a specific organization that had come under a threat because they had had their computer stolen 3 times in a year. They were working on documenting people who had been killed 30 years earlier by some military officials. So these were people that were going into the field, that were recording testimonies of people who had witnessed things. They were bringing all that information to the office using their computers and putting on their computers. They would come into the office the next morning. Either the computers would be gone. Sometimes the filing cabinets were gone. And then most recently is just the hard drives would be gone. And so they had no ways, they were just working on individual workstations. So this is an organization that had about 60 people working, and they had a problem. They needed their information backed up. And so what do you do if you have an organization with about 40 computers because they're shared sometimes, and they want to do a backup solution? And so this came to the attention of both us as well as the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And it was thanks to the U.S. organization who was working with this partner said, we really need to do something. And they said, well, if they're backing up everything on their computers, why don't we put them on a network, get a file server, and do a tunnel to do a backup using SSH, using rsync, to back up all the information on a remote site. Sounds good. What do you need to do first? You need to build a network. Right? You need to get network cards. You need to wire. And you need to find people who can support them. And so this took about 2 months to plan, to find the budget, what everything would cost. And that's one of the challenges that you get. So what did that look like? So here's the organization. We asked for volunteers in the organizations. We talked with the directors of the organization to say who are employees that are going to stay with the organization for a long time, who people tend to go to for help, either with technology or other things. And they identified 3 individuals who have been around with the organization, who tend to do things all the time. And so we had our volunteers, and then we had to train them on how to build a network. So the first thing you have to do is not bring the cables, but we had to find where you could find PVC and internet cables and crimping tools and source them locally at a cost that was far more expensive, but at least if we needed extra cable, we could find it locally. And then it was working with the people of the organization to actually, you know, do the hard work. This is before wireless was really being used. And probably still would recommend this, is build an Ethernet network with switches. So we had to help them with you know, how to wire it, how the schematic, how the network would look like, what type of cable to use, because we went to the hardware place, and they, of course, wanted to sell us the cheapest cable. And we're like, no, we want Category 5, we want these things. So the specifications, some people might not know. These organizations might not have technical people. They just will, you know how to use Word, or they may know how to use some other tool. And so we really had to help them with some of the questions. But then they were very eager to build the network. Here's someone with the PVC piping, because part of the cable had to go outside. We had to drill holes everywhere, typical things that maybe a lot of you know how to do. But these people, or this organization, didn't. And so we showed them, and none of these pictures will you see the foreigners doing it. It was the locals doing it, and that's a very important thing and part of it. And, you know, working together, it was a long day, but even at the end of the day, they were smiling, still are smiling. And here you see one of the gentlemen, you know, crimping the cable, checking to make sure. And at the end of the day, I don't have a picture of the server, we asked them to go ahead and try to install Red Hat. And here the error is, the partition is inconsistent. But they got it to this point, which was pretty good. But this took, to get to this point, took 3 days. Because it was 2 stories, and there were only three people, and we couldn't get all the supplies at once. So it takes time. And then what was the problem is then we had to find the server, the remote server, where they could do their backup. And then we found out that we couldn't get a fixed IP because Guatemala doesn't have an allocation of fixed IPs. And so then we had to do a tunnel first, then so you could reach the machine through another machine in the United States because there's just not enough static IPs. And if you wanted to get a static IP, it's an extra $500 a month, or it was at the time 2 years ago. And so that was one of the problems. Over the course of the 2 years that they now have a backup solution, the backup server is now full. And of course, because it was a remote site, the server was full. You don't want to, where do you put the server? Do you put it in someone's home? Do you put it in some organization? So it was with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a known international organization. They have a human rights program, or did at the time. But, the 500 gigabyte drive filled in 2 years. And so, one of the expert technicians in the U.S., took a look inside the drive, and why is this filled? And of course, he found a lot of porn and a lot of MP3s. And so then the question is, well, we didn't tell the people at the beginning that they couldn't collect pictures. And it was backing up everything that they were installing on their computer. So someone had, peer-to-peer programs, and it was just doing a remote backup. And so, in retrospect, then you have to think about that, too. If you're putting a backup procedure in place and you're doing a remote backup, what can you put in so you don't make a backup of people's porn? And then the problem was that it needed to be restored. Luckily there were people, but that's the other thing, is to do a backup is maybe simple, but how do you run it in reverse? What is it that needs to be installed on a Linux server so the person just goes, knows what to do? So having written instructions is very important. And so one thing, I guess, mixing with the technology is that you saw there was cabling, you saw there were computers. One has to remember that, as I mentioned earlier, that these type of organizations, their primary job isn't IT, isn't computers, isn't security. It's just working with human rights, and you'll see a picture of what that means. They collect some very important information, as I said, witness testimonies. They'll collect information about witnesses where they're being safely protected, but also information about people who have died. Also forensic information, and they have to collect it. They have to keep not only the computer-generated information, but also the original source information as well, too. So when one talks about backing up data or protecting data, it's not just bits. It's not just ones and zeros. It's physical things, too. So if one wants to help them, this is one organization in Guatemala that is a forensic anthropology. And so what they do is they go to the countryside when people from the countryside say, we found some bones. And they will go, they will dig up the bones, bring them for analysis to see, well, who are these people? And this is something in Guatemala that there was a lot of massacres and people were buried in mass graves. And so then these bones get taken back, they get analyzed to see what was the cause of death. And so they have a file on each individual, particular characteristics. And when they find a skull, the skull might have a bullet hole. There might be a bullet. And then so you have to accumulate all that information and protect it, because together with the physical evidence that you might store, is then if you then compile all the different electronic data that you find, you might be able to build a case. And so one of the organizations, what they were doing is they did, I think it was over 400 or 500 exhumations, and they added this to their a court case that they launched to bring people to trial. And they can say, well, we know that this general was involved, he was in this area, and people died. And we know who the people were, and we've done all the things. So this is what we're talking, when we talk about human rights organizations in different countries, this is the work. So it's a reality check to remember. And again, this is Guatemala. And the one thing I want to finish with is I was just there 2 weeks ago. And I found there was an interesting thing that was told to me, is that over the course of the last 5 years, 10 years, and since 96, when there was the peace accords, There's been the population in a lot of the organizations and the human rights organizations that really want to find out what happened during the years of the military dictatorship. And the first thing people asked is, well, we know the police were involved. Can we have access to the police records? And the government, they don't exist. The records don't exist at all. And, you know, for 10 years, they would try to look. Nothing would be found. And then just this May, at one of the military barracks, there was an explosion. And one of the government investigators with the Human Rights Office said, let's go visit all the different places where they have military explosives, you know, to see what other things they might be hiding or not. And so they went to the first place where there was the explosion. They didn't say, find anything. But they said, oh, there's this other military dump in Guatemala City. You might want to go there. So they did. And they found some interesting things. And I'll take you through some of the pictures. So the place that they found was in a residential part of Guatemala. This is what kind of it looks like. Just outside the place that they went, there's a lot of police walking around, but it's a military compound, so it's fine. And as you see, and I'll translate this from the Spanish, it says, it's the service for the disactivation of explosives. So it was a munitions dump, and this is where they bring bombs and mines and other things to deactivate them. And outside you find, because it's a police thing, old police cars. Cars that have been impounded, you know, old vehicles. You look at the outside of the facility, and what does it look like? It looks like this. Not really in really good shape. And the woman that was giving us the tour is there. And so what happens is these government officials went to this place. They walked down these stairs, and where you see all the trash, they found stuff like this. Documents. And I'll show you a few pictures in a moment, but they started seeing that these are photocopies of national ID cards, documents that were either bound up or a lot of documents that were just piled everywhere. And what they had found is they had found the archive that they had been searching for the last 10 years. And when they went through, they basically found out that almost all of the police archives from 1904 and to the present were being stored here. And the first thing that they said is, we need to protect this. And so they got a judicial order to make sure that the police wouldn't want to destroy it. The second thing is they took a look and they invited some international experts. There's an organization in the U.S. called the National Security Archive, known as the NSA, but they're the good NSA. And they're involved in declassifying government documents. And so they work with a lot of they declassify U.S. government documents, but also with archives around the world. And so they immediately call the people from the good NSA in the U.S., to say, look what we found, can you come and pay us a visit? So if you go to the, I can show you the photos from the NSA. And they basically found, again, documents from 1904 to the present. When they asked the women who were working there, and there's about 8 of them at the time, and still am, and have always worked there, as they said, you know, how are these things organized? You know, we want to find out what happened during this time period. They said, they're all organized according to year, what part of the country, and what police station it came from. That's how it's organized. And so you have a very big facility, that's how it's organized. And in terms of the pictures, you have one place you had 8-inch discs. I hadn't seen them in years, so that was really interesting. No computers to read them, by the way, but you could see the 8-inch discs. Piles and piles of documents everywhere. The problem was with the documents is that some of them are nicely organized. Others are not. And as you can see in this place, in a concrete structure, in a country that has a very nice rainy season, You saw the outside of the building. Well, what happens on the inside is, well, water will fall. Paper will rot. And so this was 2 weeks ago. Apparently in May, things were a lot worse. In this photo, you probably see like a little black object towards the middle top. Looks like a little small window. So this is a room that they showed us. And I immediately took a picture because the moment we opened the door, all these bats flew out of the room. And so, you know, these are rooms that aren't really kept in really good conditions to save documents. There's water, there's animals. Apparently they had fumigated so that there weren't any rats. But just documents everywhere. And so this is a group of the people who they had taken one of the rooms, painted it, cleaned it up, and, you know, they're still afraid that these documents might disappear. And so, because it's still owned by the police, but there's a judicial order to protect it, these people, there's always, between the different organizations, there's always people that actually sleep there. In case anything happens, they all have cell phones, and they can immediately phone, you know, their colleagues. But they're also working to go through all the documents, because apparently, the estimate is that there are 75 million pages of documents, none of which are really there's a catalog or an index. So the big challenge is, can you digitize this? And so one of the questions a lot of the organizations are asking is, how is it that you could digitize this? How much it would cost and who could do it? And so organizations like from the Internet Archive and other organizations are being asked as well, well, what is it that you can do to help this? And when I was shown this 2 weeks ago and I said, well, I'm coming to Berlin to this conference to some people that might be interested, you know, what is it that I can, the message that I can tell people about, you know, your situation, said, just tell them about it. We want people to know. And if there's anything that they can help, just to know about it, because, you know, the government can take it away from us. And if there's any experience in regards to a lot of government documents that get found and what people do with them, it would be a good idea. I don't think the person had a context in terms of, you know, if we're talking about Berlin in terms of, you know, mysterious government documents that suddenly appear, well, you know, the Stasi files come to mind. And so if anyone here had experience in terms of digitizing them, in terms of categorizing them, there are people in other parts of the world that are interested in this, because it's how you can share your experience here with them. And so that's the connection a little bit with Berlin. And so I want to wrap up because I want to take some questions as well, is just a couple of things in terms of some of the lessons that we've learned. Some of them I've mentioned in them already, is to really keep the explanation simple, to really get to the core message and make sure they understand that, not that whether they should use RSA versus DSA, it's that they should use encryption. So that's important. And to explain things in a very illustrative fashion, it helps a great deal. In regards to secure communications tool, there's a lot of tools. Everyone's been knows about GNU-PG, PGP. They've been using it for a long time. But, you know, I've had an experience of showing people for 4 years. It's a really great tool. You ask people 3 months later, are they still using it? And they go, no. Why? It's too difficult. And so when that's the problem, you know, what do people do? Well, depending on what platform they use, is sometimes they only encrypt the message but not the attachment. Sometimes the plugins don't work, but sometimes the subject lines reveal what the message is. And so the tools have to get a lot easier. But the other thing, too, is to remember Ellison's Law, which is that the user base for strong cryptography declines by half by each additional keystroke or mouse click that's required. And so what you really need to do is something that opportunistically encrypts, something that just occurs behind the scenes. If you're installing an operating system, if people are being shown how to use bootable Linux, NOPIX, or other things, is to make sure all these things are built in and turned on. Because the moment they have to install something, it just may not be installed. Or if they have to always click on something, they'll forget. So it just has to occur behind the scenes. So the transport layer stuff is very important. But also, if you're showing them new things, is they might have problems. And so they have to be able to blame someone, or they have to be able to get help. And so whatever you show people, you have to keep that in mind. That, you know, you have to, you know, a lot of people say, well, just get everyone to use Linux. You know, that's a really good thing, but if there's no one in the country who knows Linux, and you show them how to use Linux and they have a problem, they'll just uninstall Linux and install Windows again. And so maybe the thing is to find people who can train them with Linux, and then when they're ready, slowly move them over. And so there's some organizations that do that. We don't do that, but others do. What I put that is dependency on foreigners is a bad thing. So they should be able to do it themselves. Again, not only do we need good crypto, but we need usable crypto. That's very, very important and needs to be turned on. I'll finish with this slide and two pictures. Is the reason I'm excited that everyone's here, I hope it's not because of the next presentation, but I hope it's because people are here, is that something that that Frank mentioned yesterday in his talk on We Lost the War, a positive thing is that we have to try to bring different communities together. And so that's something that we've tried to do with the human rights community. And we should not give up. We should just join forces, and maybe having a larger army behind us, we can try to go forward. And I'll finish with two things. One of them is a poem that really illustrates this. It's not the desire of justice, the hope of peace, the love of a woman, or the tenderness of a guitar. It's the heart of solidarity that brings us together today. And so everyone's here for this talk, and maybe to the Congress, because they have particular things that they share. And you know, that sense of community should not be lost and should really be built on. So two things, and this is something in Spanish. It shows a community and says the democracy is work of everyone. So we all have to work together. You know, Frank said yesterday that there's maybe people in companies or maybe law enforcement who we've known that we've lost contact with. Well, we really need to work with everyone together, and it's really important. And here's the poem that you saw. This is outside of a bar in Guatemala City that was translated. So again, I thank everyone for the talk. I have, I think, about maybe 3 or 4 minutes. I took some questions earlier. Are there any questions or comments people might have now? If not, I'll be available as well. Any questions? Any questions? Going once. There are two microphones. Well, again, I thank everyone. I'll be available afterwards if anyone has any comments. So again, thank you for listening to my talk.